This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Harriet Tubman, Harriet Beecher Stowe, and Susan B. Anthony are some of the best-known social reformers in U.S. history, but many of them were inspired by a pioneer of women's rights whose name has been largely forgotten, Frances or Fanny Wright. A new podcast called Frances Wright, America's Forgotten Radical, explores her life and work. Joining me now to talk about Fanny Wright and what leaders of today could learn from her are the podcast's co-hosts, author Tristra New Year Yeager and independent scholar Eleanor Russ. Thank you so much for being here, Tristra and Eleanor.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Tristra, your podcast focuses on the life and the work of Frances Wright, also known as Fanny Wright. What makes her worthy of this 8-episode podcast?
I'll answer that. This is Eleanor. It really started in the little town of New Harmony, Indiana, where Tristra developed an obsession with the utopian communities that built the town in the early 1800s. And she told me she kept coming across this name, Frances Wright. So as fellow history buffs, we wanted to learn more. And we found that so many famous people in her time adored her, admired her work. People like Walt Whitman, the Marquis de Lafayette, Mary Shelley, the author of Frankenstein, and many of those politicians that Lindsay mentioned in the early half of the show. So we decided we had to share her story. And we thought that making a podcast would let us bring in the voices, both of Fanny herself, but also lots of other scholars. But then in podcast form, we could focus on accessible storytelling instead of really just chasing down footnotes and sharing it with a narrow audience.
And how was she ahead of her time as a young woman, Tristra? What were some of the ideas she was promoting that were really radical for their time?
Well, most of her ideas were pretty groundbreaking, though there were a few women who forged the way before her, like Mary Wollstonecraft. But she basically had, to sum it up, she had this radical idea that women are humans, much like men, and therefore they have human rights. She's very much a daughter of the Enlightenment, and particularly the Scottish Enlightenment. She was born in Scotland. So this was a time when there was still kind of this interesting debate about where women should fall into this framework of rights. And if you look at the legal landscape at the time, the Anglo-American approach, for instance, to marriage involved something called coverture, which meant that a woman didn't have any legal standing independently of her husband, her brothers, or her father, depending on where she was in her life. And Frances Wright argued that women should have property rights, that they should retain legal personhood at all stages of their life and have access to legal processes like divorce, which at the time was, it existed, but it was extremely difficult and very much not in women's favor to pursue. She also really emphasized women's inner worlds and talked about female sexuality in a way that many modern women would find very, very familiar. So she really tried to assert that women had their own desires, their own needs, and that sex could be part of women's lives, regardless of where they fell into this institutional framework of marriage and family. In some ways, she really laid out some of the groundwork that we're still trying to work through today as men and women.
We're talking about the life and work of pioneering activist Frances or Fanny Wright and what our leaders of today could learn from her. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100 or you can email talk@wvxu.org. Eleanor, you referenced that Fanny Wright was a friend with Thomas Jefferson. She was a close associate of Marquis de Lafayette. How did she become so close with these men whose names, you know, we all know?
Well, it all started with her obsession as a young woman with the project of America. A lot of Europeans were fascinated with this young country who was trying out a lot of the kind of philosophical imaginings about liberty. So she picked up, she was an heiress, so she had some independent wealth. And as a young woman, she and her sister just picked up and traveled to the U.S. by themselves without family members' support. And based on her experiences there, she wrote a book. So she was a very young woman when this first book was published. And it was basically a love letter to the United States and its promise of liberty. That was not like a common view from the conservative Europeans at the time. So those folks in especially the UK who were on the side of progressiveness, even if maybe they weren't revolutionary exactly, kind of picked her up as a promising young person who was really standing out. Marquis de Lafayette, who was, you know, kind of a rock star, a transatlantic rock star at that time. He developed such a close relationship with her that he talked about adopting her. They really vibed on that promise of liberty and reform. And that's what brought her back to the United States. The Marquis de Lafayette did this kind of victory lap tour, traveling all over the young U.S. In the 1820s. Frances came along, and that's how she got deeper into what was really going on throughout the states and met all of those famous people like Thomas Jefferson.
Mm. Eleanor or Tristra, whoever wants to weigh in on this, you've got hours of material in your podcast. We can't cover it all here, of course, but I do want to talk about Frances Wright as a public speaker. How unusual was that for a woman at the time, and how did that get started?
Well, it was super unusual for a woman to speak publicly to mixed groups of genders, men and women, about secular ideas. Public speaking was a huge part of public life and just the way people shared ideas. You know, this is the time when literacy is rising, but, you know, not universal. And it's also a time when women were beginning to speak in religious revivals. This was a period in American culture known as the Second Great Awakening, where religious commitment and religious gatherings were very important. In fact, contemporary Frances Trollope, I know too many Franceses, she says that Cincinnati women's main social outlet was to go to these religious revivals. So Frances was kind of operating a secular parallel. She founded something called the Hall of Science in New York City, really as a venue to speak publicly on her ideas about liberty, about women's rights, about working men's rights, and also to provide educational content for working class New Yorkers. So while women were finding their voice in many ways, Frances was super unusual for being so loud, so outspoken about secular things outside that religious context.
Tristra, one of her important early lectures was in Cincinnati. What made her believe Cincinnati needed to hear from her?
Well, that's a really great question. I would say Cincinnati was in a unique position at the time. It was kind of like the most hoppin' metropolis on what at the time was the American frontier. And as a river town, I think there were a lot of different influences. There were a lot of different people with, you know, various viewpoints. And it was a boom town, right? I mean, its real boom age came a little bit later, but it was starting to grow. There was a lot going on. And so I think she felt like Cincinnati had the potential to be open-minded enough to embrace some of her wilder ideas, wilder for her age. And one of her dress rehearsals was in the town of New Harmony that we already mentioned. And I think, you know, like Cincinnati, it was one of the more open-minded spots on the frontier. So she really wanted to get an audience where she might get enough of a good reception to get some quality feedback on what she was saying.
How did it go over for her?
Specifically in Cincinnati, I don't have that info right at my fingertips, but she was notorious for causing disturbances. So in Philadelphia, in New York, there was a lot of very contentious discussion in the media about whether she should be allowed to speak. A lot of her speaking events were shut down by local authorities, or she found it very difficult to lease a hall to find a place to speak. There was even a couple instances where there were some little minor riots. Though I want to note that getting really agitated about a theater event or about speaking was more common in the early 19th century than it might be today. So saying there was a mini riot, isn't as extreme sounding as it might be if we had, I don't know, a riot here in the Midwest.
It feels more like a Taylor Swift show in vibe than like a public lecture at a university now.
Exactly.
Just on vibes.
Yeah, exactly. She actually had a small group of bodyguards, including some female bodyguards that helped her move, like, you know, to the podium and away from it. So she, at the moment, she kind of went viral, to put it in contemporary terms.
Well, Eleanor, you know, we've talked about some of the topics she dealt with, the fact that it was so unusual that she was a woman as a public speaker. But can you tell from looking at the historic record, was there something about, you know, more about the topics that she tackled or the way she expressed herself that set her apart, that really made her the T. Swift of her time?
Well, I have to say that reading the speeches now at a time when public speaking is not our major form of entertainment, it is a little hard to see what made people so electrified. But from accounts of just interpersonal interactions, it seems she just had a ton of charisma. She could get people on her side, behind her projects, believing in her in a way that's really special. And I have to imagine that translated to the stage, even if the printed words don't always communicate that. One thing I see in her speeches, even through that having to kind of translate a little bit through that lens, is she, even though she does a lot of criticizing of the status quo, especially the power, the growing power of clergy in American politics, and the state of women's rights at the time, she has a lot to say about her ideal world. She really believes in the idea of American liberty as a project that wasn't completed yet, but could be. So I feel like there's a lot of hope in reform and change that just feels energizing, even if she's also saying some things that got people mad.
Yeah, she had this incredible ability to sort of evoke the future world as something desirable and yet attainable through the tools and means that were at her disposal right then. So that was, in some ways, that was part of the whole utopian spirit that inhabited a lot of American thinking at the time. And that is something that I think Eleanor and I both found really appealing and inspiring. It's not a perspective that many people feel they can take right now. And it's really difficult to articulate a constructive vision, but she managed it. And she was also an extraordinary person physically. She was very tall for a woman of her time. She's about 5'11". She was very graceful and she had a very distinct personal style. So she drew on some of the tropes of the classical world. She's very inspired by Epicurus and Greek philosophy and the way some Greek philosophers treated women in their circles. And so she would wear these kind of garments that suggested, Greek sort of, draped garments. And she had this very specific haircut. And she apparently had a beautiful voice and a way of speaking that really drew people to her. So, her words were almost maybe less important to some of her audience members than just the way she held herself and the dignity and care she exhibited as a speaker.
You know, we think of our country as being so divided right now. We just talked about election anxiety. How different was the country back then? Because your podcast describes America as kind of a screamy, argumentative place at the time she was doing her thing.
Totally, totally. We have always loved to argue as Americans. And I think, we also have a lot of, mechanisms for papering over some of those tensions, especially here in the Midwest. And some of those maybe have fallen a little bit out of practice. We've gotten a little out of practice due to things like social media. But what we found when looking at Wright's life and the writing about her and her own writing was people were really, really wound up about these issues, and rightfully so. I mean, slavery was a major issue for America, and for many Americans, it felt like something that had to be addressed as quickly as possible and corrected because it did contradict the basic principles of the country that were espoused by everyone. But there were also smaller controversies that Wright got embroiled in regularly, and she really seemed to enjoy the debate. But I think we do need to remember that we have always been people with lots of different perspectives who really, really enjoy a good argument.
What are some of the other ways she kind of broke through that noise? If everybody's kind of arguing and debating, and that was kind of the currency of the day. You mentioned, her appearance, her voice, obviously her ideas. Was she also especially good at finding common ground and being persuasive?
I would say yes, in that she was really good. I mean, if you look at some of her projects, so she lived her values and she was very willing to put her money where her mouth was. And she was also really willing to talk to a wide variety of people. So she was very anti-slavery, yet she would speak with enslavers and talk to them about their needs and their interests and why they continued to pursue that, you know, way of life and that, you know, economic model, or however we want to talk about slavery. And because she was so open to their concerns, she was able to draw together some ideas with, for instance, her project of Neshoba, which was an intentional community meant to demonstrate how slavery could be unwound very purposefully to the benefit of both African-Americans who would be manumitted and liberated, and to the benefit and to the non-detriment of enslavers. Because, you know, just to give a tiny bit of historical context, at the time, Britain had done away with slavery and had basically made payments to enslavers to compensate them for the loss of their quote unquote property. And this was a devastating financial move that I believe they just paid off. Mm-hmm. The UK just paid off this debt in, you know, living memory. Yeah. And so obviously the United States was not as wealthy. There was no way that was going to happen. And so Frances Wright really wanted to propose a way that could somewhat appease all sides. So in that way, she was really good at finding common ground, even with people that would, she might have considered her ideological enemies. And you know, it's somewhat unpalatable for us today to think about some of these compromises around moral issues like slavery and the humanity of a certain category of Americans. But it was at the time a radical and very, very bold move. And a lot of people found it very persuasive, even if they weren't sure if it would work. So Madison was interested. Thomas Jefferson had a lot of thoughts about it. And, you know, the Marquis de Lafayette was a supporter, and there were many, many other like average Americans who read about this project and followed it and supported her in certain ways. So she was a very interesting character, even though she loved to like get people riled up. She would practically try to, you know, create something of a compromise.
So what can we learn from her story about how to discuss or debate challenging and polarizing issues?
I definitely think that focus on like a positive future is one of those things that I take from her, and being really, really committing. I think if she was going to tell us what to do, she would say to speak boldly, maybe even to be transparent, even to the point of it kind of hurting you. But to like, just put yourself out there, put your ideas and your passions out there, and keep your focus on that hopeful future and fixing things, not just articulating the problems in detail, which she certainly did, but really to keep that focus on hope.
Yeah, she definitely lived what she spoke about. And so there was a certain amount of integrity. And from her perspective, I think she would say she was extremely rational in her approach. You know, rational is, everyone's rational, right? We're all making the most reasonable and justified arguments in our own minds. But she really did have, like, her values went all the way down to her lived experience and how she tried to conduct herself as a human. And, you know, it's much, it can be way more provocative to make bold statements or try to tell stories or make up stories or, you know, or pull little rhetorical tricks. But for her, all of that had to serve the greater good, which was, you know, she loved America for its liberty, and she wanted to see every single American free to pursue happiness, whether that person was a woman, whether that person was formerly enslaved. To her, everybody needed to have the opportunity to do what they felt called to do and to gain the education and resources to pursue that. So she absolutely believed that, and she put her money where her mouth was, as I said before.
And her reputation.
Yeah, absolutely.
She's buried in Cincinnati's Spring Grove Cemetery. How did she end up here at the end of her life?
Well, towards the end of her life, after a really stellar speaking career that also led to a ton of public backlash, because just talking about sexuality publicly as a woman got you painted with some pretty bad brushes. So she sort of faded from the public stage. And Cincinnati became her home base at that point. She was still writing. She was still corresponding. And I think she chose Cincinnati because it still was that frontier boom town, but let her be connected to all of the circles that she valued. It made it easy for her to continue traveling, but it also kept her connected to New Harmony. It kept her connected by river to the East Coast as well.
And down in New Orleans. So New Orleans was an important port. You could get to, Western Europe relatively easily from there. And she often did travel that route. So I think it just felt like a good mm-hmm. central spot, as well as a town with lots going on. And she had a lot of friends there. She had
like Josiah Warren, who's best known for his Time Store in what's now downtown Cincinnati. He's a little bit of a local legend, kook.
He's awesome.
He's super awesome. But
So if she's T Swift,
she was also admired. Yeah. She was also mired in lawsuits that made it, I think, that kind of like colored her last years. So she did end up dying at not a super old age. She was in her 50s.
Yeah.
And although she was not super well off or super famous, her daughter inherited the remains of her wealth and established this beautiful obelisk in Spring Grove Cemetery to her memory. Mm.
Well, I've been talking with co-hosts of the podcast, Frances Wright, America's Forgotten Radical, author Trista Newyear Yeager, and independent scholar Eleanor Rust. You can find their series wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Asiya Johnson. Technical director is Marshall Verbsky. And if you miss our program live, you can subscribe to Cincinnati Edition wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Lucy May. Thanks for listening.